box full of jewelry. But she kept eyeing up the pink plastic mobile phone my father had bought me, which was one of the only toys I had. My father was always talking on his mobile phone, so I loved to copy him and pretend to make calls on mine. One day, it disappeared. A few days later, I saw Safina playing with a phone exactly the same as mine. "Where did you get that?" I asked. "I bought it in the bazaar," she said. I realize now she could have been telling the truth, but back then I thought, she is doing this to me, and I will do the same to her. I used to go to her house to study, so whenever I was there, I would pocket her things, mostly toy jewelry like earrings and necklaces. It was easy. At first, stealing gave me a thrill, but that did not last long. Soon, it became a compulsion. I did not know how to stop. One afternoon, I came home from school and rushed into the kitchen as usual for a snack. "Hello, Barbie," I called. "I'm starving." There was silence. My mother was sitting on the floor pounding spices, brightly colored turmeric and cumin filling the air with their aroma. Over and over she pounded. Her eyes would not meet mine. What had I done? I was very sad and went to my room. When I opened my cupboard, I saw that all the things I had taken were gone. I had been caught. My cousin Rina came into my room. "They knew you were stealing," she said. "They were waiting for you to come clean, but you just kept on." I felt a terrible sinking feeling in my stomach. I walked back to my mother with my head bowed. "What you did was wrong, Malala," she said. "Are you trying to bring shame on us that we can't afford to buy such things?" "It's not true," I lied. "I didn't take them." But she knew I had. "Safina started it," I protested. "She took the pink phone that Abba bought me." My mother was unmoved. "Safina is younger than you, and you should have taught her better," she said. "You should have set an example." I started crying and apologized over and over again. "Don't tell Abba," I begged. I couldn't bear for him to be disappointed in me. It's horrible to feel unworthy in the eyes of your parents. It wasn't the first time. When I was little, I went to the bazaar with my mother and spotted a pile of almonds on a cart. They looked so tasty that I couldn't resist grabbing a handful. My mother told me off and apologized to the cart owner. He was furious and would not be placated. We still had little money, and my mother checked her purse to see what she had. "Can you sell them for 10 rupees? She asked. "No," he replied. "Almonds are very costly." My mother was very upset and told my father. He immediately went and bought the whole lot and put them in a glass dish. "Almonds are good," he said. "If you eat them with your milk just before bed, it makes you brainy." But I knew he didn't have much money, and the almonds in the dish were a reminder of my guilt. I promised myself I'd never do such a thing again. And now I had. My mother took me to say sorry to Safina and her parents. It was very hard. Safina said nothing about my phone, which didn't seem fair, but I didn't mention it either. Though I felt bad, I was also relieved it was over. Since that day, I have never lied nor stolen. Not a single lie, nor a single penny, not even the coins my father leaves around the house, which we are allowed to buy snacks with. I also stopped wearing jewelry because I asked myself, what are these baubles which tempt me? Why should I lose character for a few metal trinkets? But I still feel guilty, and to this day I say sorry to God in my prayers. My mother and father tell each other everything, so he soon found out why I was so sad. I could see in his eyes that I had failed him. I wanted him to be proud of me, like he was when I was presented with the first-in-year trophies at school. Or the day our kindergarten teacher, Miss Ulfat, told him I had written "only speak in Urdu" on the blackboard for my classmates at the start of an Urdu lesson so we would learn the language faster. My father consoled me by telling me about the mistakes great heroes made when they were children. He told me that Mahatma Gandhi said, "Freedom is not worth having if it does not include the freedom to make mistakes." At school, we had read stories about our founder, Muhammad Ali Jinnah. As a boy in Karachi, he would study by the glow of streetlights because there was no light at home. He told other boys to stop playing marbles in the dust and to play cricket instead so their clothes and hands wouldn't get dirty. At school, my father has a framed copy of a letter written by Abraham Lincoln to his son's teacher, translated into Pashto. It's a very beautiful letter, full of good advice. Teach him, if you can, the wonder of books, but also give him quiet time to ponder the eternal mystery of birds in the sky, bees in the sun, and the flowers on a green hillside, it says. Teach him it is far more honorable to fail than to cheat. I think everyone makes a mistake at least once in their life. The important thing is what you learn from it. That's why I have problems with our Pashtun Wali code. We're supposed to take revenge for wrongs done to us. But where does that end? If a man in one family is killed or hurt by another man, revenge must be exacted to restore what we call nung or honor. It can be taken by killing any male member of the attacker's family. Then that family in turn must take revenge. And on it goes. There is no time limit. We have a saying. The Pashtun took revenge after 20 years and another said it was taken too soon. We are a people of many sayings. One is, the stone of Pashto does not rust in water, which means we neither forget nor forgive. That's also why we rarely use the word thank you, manana, because we believe a Pashtun will never forget a good deed and is bound to reciprocate at some point, just as he will a bad one. Kindness can only be repaid with kindness. It can't be repaid with expressions like thank you. Many families live in walled compounds with watchtowers so they can keep an eye out for their enemies. We knew many victims of feuds. One was Sher Zaman, a man who had been in my father's class and always got better grades than him. My grandfather and uncle used to drive my father mad, teasing him, "You're not as good as Sher Zaman." So much so, he once wished that rocks would come down the mountain and flatten him. But Sher Zaman did not go to college and ended up becoming a dispenser in the village pharmacy. His family became embroiled in a dispute with their cousins over a small plot of forest. One day, when Sher Zaman and two of his brothers were on their way to the land, they were ambushed by his uncle and some of his men. All three brothers were killed. As a respected man in the community, my father was often called to mediate feuds. He did not believe in badal, revenge, and would try to make people see that neither side had anything to gain from continuing the violence, and it would be better for them to get on with their lives. There were two families in our village whom he could not convince. They had been locked in a feud for so long, no one even seemed to remember how it had started. Probably some small slight, as we are hot-headed people. First, a brother on one side would attack an uncle on the other, then vice versa. It consumed their lives. Our people say it is a good system, and our crime rate is much lower than in non-Pashtun areas. But I think if someone kills your brother, you shouldn't kill them or their brother. You should teach them instead. I am inspired by Khan Abdul Ghaffar Khan, the man who some call the Frontier Gandhi, who introduced a non-violent philosophy to our culture. It's the same with stealing. Some people, like me, get caught and vow they will never do it again. Others say, Oh, it's no big deal. It was just a little thing. But the second time they will steal something bigger. And the third, something bigger still. In my country, too many politicians think nothing of stealing. They are rich and we are a poor country, yet they loot and loot. Most of them don't pay tax, but that's the least of it. They take out loans from state banks, but they don't pay them back. They get kickbacks on government contracts from friends or the companies they award them to. Many of them own expensive flats in London. I don't know how they can live with their consciences when they see our people going hungry or sitting in the darkness of endless power cuts, children unable to go to school as their parents need them to work. My father says that Pakistan has been cursed with more than its fair share of politicians who only think about money. They don't care if the army is actually flying the plane. They are happy to stay out of the cockpit and sit in business class, close the curtains and enjoy the fine food and service, while the rest of us are squashed in economy. I had been born into a sort of democracy where for 10 years, Benazir Bhutto and Nawaz Sharif kept replacing each other, none of their governments ever completing a term and always accusing each other of corruption. But 2 years after I was born, the generals again took over. It happened in a manner so dramatic that it sounds like something out of a movie. Nawaz Sharif was prime minister at the time and had fallen out with his army chief General Pervez Musharraf and sacked him. At the time, General Musharraf was on a plane of our national airline PIA coming back from Sri Lanka. Nawaz Sharif was so worried about his reaction that he tried to stop the plane from landing in Pakistan. He ordered Karachi Airport to switch off its landing lights and to park fire engines on the runway to block the plane, even though it had 200 other passengers on board and not enough fuel to get to another country. Within an hour of the announcement on television of Musharraf's sacking, tanks were on the streets and troops had taken over the newsrooms and the airports. The local commander, General Iftikhar, stormed the control tower at Karachi so that Musharraf's plane could land. Musharraf then seized power and threw Sharif into a dungeon in Atok Fort. Some people celebrated by handing out sweets as Sharif was unpopular, but my father cried when he heard the news. He had thought we were done with military dictatorships. Sharif was accused of treason and only saved by his friends in the Saudi royal family who arranged his exile. Musharraf was our fourth military ruler. Like all our dictators, he started by addressing the nation on TV, beginning, "Meri Aziz Hamwatano, my dear countrymen," then went into a long tirade against Sharif, saying under him Pakistan had lost our honor, dignity and respect. He vowed to end corruption and go after those guilty of plundering and looting the national wealth. He promised he would make his own assets and tax return public. He said he would only run the country for a short time, but no one believed him. General Zia had promised to be in power for 90 days and had stayed more than 11 years until he was killed in an air crash. "It's the same old story," my father said, and he was right. Musharraf promised to end the old feudal system in which the same few dozen families controlled the entire country and bring fresh young clean faces into politics. Instead, his cabinet was made up of the very same old faces. Once again, our country was expelled from the Commonwealth and became an international black sheep. The Americans had already suspended most aid the year before when we conducted nuclear tests, but now almost everyone boycotted us. With such a history, you can see why the people of Swat did not always think it was a good idea to be part of Pakistan. Every few years, Pakistan sent us a new deputy commissioner, or DC, to govern Swat, just as the British had done in colonial days. It seemed to us that these bureaucrats came to our province simply to get rich, then went back home. They had no interest in developing Swat. Our people were used to being subservient because under the Wali, no criticism was tolerated. If anyone offended him, their entire family could be expelled from Swat. So when the DCs came from Pakistan, they were the new kings and no one questioned them. Older people often looked back nostalgically to the days of the last Wali. Back then, they said, the mountains were all still covered in trees. There were schools every 5 kilometers, and the Wali Sahib would visit them in person to resolve problems. After what happened with Safina, I vowed that I would never treat a friend badly again. My father always says it's important to treat friends well. When he was at college and had no money for food or books, many of his friends helped him out, and he never forgot that. I have 3 good friends, Safina from my area, Sumbul from the village, and Muniba from school. Muniba had become my best friend in primary school when we lived near each other, and I persuaded her to come to our school. She is a wise girl, though we often fall out, particularly when we go on school trips. She comes from a large family with 3 sisters and 4 brothers. I think of her as my big sister, even though I am 6 months older than her. Muniba sets down rules which I try to follow. We don't have secrets from each other, and we don't share our secrets with anyone else. She doesn't like me talking to other girls, and says we must be careful of associating with people who are badly behaved or have a reputation for trouble. She always says, I have 4 brothers, and if I do even the slightest thing wrong, they can stop me going to school. I was so eager not to disappoint my parents again that I ran errands for anyone. One day, our neighbors asked me to buy some maize for them from the bazaar. On the way, a boy on a bicycle crashed into me, and my left shoulder hurt so much that my eyes watered. But I still went and bought the maize, took it to my neighbors, and then went home. Only then did I cry. Shortly after that, I found the perfect way to try to win back the respect of my father. Notices had gone up at school for a public speaking competition, and Muniba and I both decided to enter. I remembered the story of my father surprising my grandfather and longed to do the same. When we got the topic, I couldn't believe my eyes. It was honesty is the best policy. The only practice we'd had was reading out poems at morning assembly. But there was an older girl at school called Fatima, who was a very good speaker. She was beautiful and spoke in an animated way. She could speak confidently in front of hundreds of people, and they would hang on her every word. Muniba and I longed to be like her and studied her carefully. In our culture, speeches are usually written by our fathers, uncles, or teachers. They tend to be in English or Urdu, not in our native Pashto. We thought speaking in English meant you were more intelligent. We were wrong, of course. It does not matter what language you choose. The important thing is the words you use to express yourself. Muniba's speech was written by one of her older brothers. She quoted beautiful poems by Allama Iqbal, a national poet. My father had written my speech. In it, he argued that if you want to do good, but do it in a bad way, that's still bad. In the same way, if you choose a good method to do something bad, it's still bad. He ended it with Lincoln's words. It is far more honorable to fail than to cheat. On the day, only 8 or 9 boys and girls turned up. Muniba spoke well. She was very composed, and her speech was more emotional and poetic than mine, though mine might have had the better message. I was so nervous before the speech. I was trembling with fear. My grandfather had come to watch, and I knew he really wanted me to win the competition, which made me even more nervous. I remembered what my father had said about taking a deep breath before starting. But then I saw that all eyes were on me, and I rushed through. I kept losing my place as the pages danced in my shaking hands. But as I ended with Lincoln's words, I looked up at my father. He was smiling. When the judges announced the results at the end, Muniba won. I came second. It didn't matter. Lincoln also wrote in the letter to his son's teacher, "Teach him how to gracefully lose." I was used to coming top of my class. But I realized that even if you win 3 or 4 times, the next victory will not necessarily be yours without trying. And also, that sometimes it's better to tell your own story. I started writing my own speeches and changing the way I delivered them, from my heart, rather than from a sheet of paper. 6. Children of the Rubbish Mountain. As Khushal's school started to attract more pupils, we moved again and finally had a television. My favorite program was Shakalaka Boom Boom, an Indian children's series about a boy called Sanju who has a magic pencil. Everything he drew became real. If he drew a vegetable or a policeman, the vegetable or policeman would magically appear. If he accidentally drew a snake, he could erase it and the snake would disappear. He used his pencil to help people. He even saved his parents from gangsters. And I wanted that magic pencil more than anything in the world. At night, I would pray, "God, give me Sanju's pencil. I won't tell anyone. Just leave it in my cupboard. I will use it to make everyone happy." As soon as I finished praying, I would check the drawer. The pencil was never there, but I knew who I would help first. Just along the street from our new house was an abandoned strip of land that people used as a rubbish dump. There is no rubbish collection in Swat. Quickly, it became a rubbish mountain. I didn't like walking near it as it smelled so bad. Sometimes we would spot black rats running through it and crows would circle overhead. One day, my brothers were not home and my mother had asked me to throw away some potato peel and eggshells. I wrinkled my nose as I approached, swatting away flies and making sure I didn't step on anything in my nice shoes. As I threw the rubbish on the mountain of rotting food, I saw something move and I jumped. It was a girl about my age. Her hair was matted and her skin was covered in sores. She looked like I imagined Shashaka, the dirty woman they told us about in Tales in the Village to make us wash. The girl had a big sack and was sorting rubbish into piles, one for cans, one for bottle tops, another for glass, and another for paper. Nearby, there were boys fishing in the pile for metal using magnets on strings. I wanted to talk to the children, but I was too scared. That afternoon, when my father came home from school, I told him about the scavenger children and begged him to go with me to look. He tried to talk to them, but they ran away. He explained that the children would sell what they had sorted to a garbage shop for a few rupees. The shop would then sell it on at a profit. On the way back home, I noticed that he was in tears. "Abba, you must give them free places at your school," I begged. He laughed. My mother and I had already persuaded him to give free places to a number of girls. Though my mother was not educated, she was the practical one in the family, the doer, while my father was the talker. She was always out helping people. My father would get angry sometimes. He would arrive home at lunchtime and call out, "Tor pe khai, I'm home," only to find she was out and there was no lunch for him. Then he would find she was at the hospital visiting someone who was ill or had gone to help a family, so he could not stay cross. Sometimes, though, she would be out because she was shopping for clothes in Chima Bazaar, and that would be a different matter. Wherever we lived, my mother filled our house with people. I shared my room with my cousin Anisa from the village, who had come to live with us so she could go to school, and a girl called Shehnaz, whose mother Sultana had once worked in our house. Shehnaz and her sister had also been sent out to collect garbage after their father had died, leaving them very poor. One of her brothers was mentally ill and was always doing strange things like setting fire to their clothes or selling the electric fan we gave them to keep them cool. Sultana was very short-tempered and my mother did not like having her in the house. But my father arranged a small allowance for her and a place for Shehnaz and her other brother at his school. Shehnaz had never been to school, so even though she was 2 years older than me, she was put 2 classes below and she came to live with us so that I could help her. There was also Nuria, whose mother, Karo, did some of our washing and cleaning, and Alishba, one of the daughters of Khalida, the woman who helped my mother with the cooking. Khalida had been sold into marriage to an old man who used to beat her, and eventually she ran away with her 3 daughters. Her own family would not take her back, because it is believed that a woman who has left her husband has brought shame on her family. For a while, her daughters also had to collect rubbish to survive. Her story was like something out of the novels I had started reading. The school had expanded a lot by then and had 3 buildings. The original one in Ladikas was a primary school, and then there was a high school for girls on Yahya Street and one for boys with a big garden of roses near the remains of the Buddhist temple. We had about 800 students in total, and although the school was not really making money, my father gave away more than 100 free places. One of them was to a boy whose father, Sharafat Ali, had helped my father when he was a penniless college student. They were friends from the village, and Sharafat Ali worked at the electricity company, so he would give my father a few hundred rupees whenever he could spare them. My father was happy to be able to repay his kindness. Another was a girl in my class called Khausa, whose father embroidered clothes and shawls, a trade our region is famous for. When we went on school trips to visit the mountains, I knew she couldn't afford them, so I would pay for her place with my pocket money. Giving places to poor children didn't just mean my father lost their fees. Some of the richer parents took their children out of school when they realized they were sharing classrooms with the sons and daughters of people who cleaned their houses or stitched their clothes. They thought it was shameful for their children to mix with those from poor families. My mother said it was hard for the poor children to learn when they were not getting enough food at home, so some of the girls would come to our house for breakfast. My father joked that our home had become a boarding house. Having so many people around made it hard to study. I had been delighted to have my own room, and my father had even bought me a dressing table to work on. But now I had 2 other girls in the room. "I want space," I'd cry. But then I felt guilty, as I knew we were lucky. I thought back to the children working on the rubbish heap. I kept seeing the dirty face of the girl from the dump, and continued to pester my father to give them places at our school. He tried to explain that those children were breadwinners, so if they went to school even for free, the whole family would go hungry. However, he got a wealthy philanthropist, Azadeh Khan, to pay for him to produce a leaflet asking, "Kya husool e ilam in bachcho ka haq nahi? Is education not the right of these children?" My father printed thousands of these leaflets, left them at local meetings, and distributed them around town. By then, my father was becoming a well-known figure in Swat. Even though he was not a Khan or a rich man, people listened to him. They knew he would have something interesting to say at workshops and seminars, and wasn't afraid to criticize the authorities, even the army, which was now running our country. He was becoming known to the army too, and friends told him that the local army commander had called him lethal in public. My father didn't know what exactly the brigadier meant, but in our country where the army is so powerful, it did not bode well. One of his pet hates was the ghost schools, where influential people in remote areas took money from the government for schools which never saw a single pupil. Instead, they used the buildings for their hujras or even to keep their animals. There was even a case of a man drawing a teacher's pension when he had never taught a day in his life. Aside from corruption and bad government, my father's main concern in those days was the environment. Mingora was expanding quickly. Around 175,000 people now called it home. And our once fresh air was becoming very polluted from all the vehicles and cooking fires. The beautiful trees on our hills and mountains were being chopped for timber. My father said only around half the town's population had access to safe drinking water, and most, like us, had no sanitation. So he and his friends set up something called the Global Peace Council, which, despite its name, had very local concerns. The name was ironic, and my father often laughed about it. But the organization's aim was serious: to try to preserve the environment of Swat and promote peace and education among local people. My father also loved to write poetry, sometimes about love, but often on controversial themes such as honor killings and women's rights. Once he visited Afghanistan for a poetry festival at the Kabul Intercontinental Hotel, where he read a poem about peace. It was mentioned as the most inspiring in the closing speech, and some in the audience asked him to repeat whole stanzas and couplets, exclaiming, "Wow, wow," when a particular line pleased them, which is a bit like bravo. Even my grandfather was proud. "Son, may you be the star in the sky of knowledge," he used to say. We too were proud, but his higher profile meant we didn't see him very much. It was always our mother who shopped for our clothes and took us to the hospital if we were ill. Even though in our culture, particularly for those of us from villages, a woman is not supposed to do these things alone. So one of my father's nephews would have to go along. When my father was at home, he and his friends sat on the roof at dusk and talked politics endlessly. There was really only one subject, 9/11. It might have changed the whole world, but we were living right in the epicenter of everything. Osama bin Laden, the leader of Al-Qaeda, had been living in Kandahar when the attack on the World Trade Center happened, and the Americans had sent thousands of troops to Afghanistan to catch him and overthrow the Taliban regime, which had protected him. In Pakistan, we were still under a dictatorship, but America needed our help, just as it had in the 1980s to fight the Russians in Afghanistan. Just as the Russian invasion of Afghanistan had changed everything for General Zia, so 9/11 transformed General Musharraf from an international outcast. Suddenly, he was being invited to the White House by President George W. Bush and to 10 Downing Street by Prime Minister Tony Blair. There was a major problem, however. Our own intelligence service, ISI, had virtually created the Taliban. Many officers were close to its leaders, having known them for years, and shared some of their beliefs. The ISI's Colonel Imam boasted he had trained 90,000 Taliban fighters and even became Pakistan's consul general in Herat during the Taliban regime. We were not fans of the Taliban, as we had heard they destroyed girls' schools and blew up giant Buddha statues. We had many Buddhas of our own that we were proud of. But many Pashtuns did not like the bombing of Afghanistan, or the way Pakistan was helping the Americans, even if it was only by allowing them to cross our airspace and stopping weapon supplies to the Taliban. We did not know then that Musharraf was also letting the Americans use our airfields. Some of our religious people saw Osama bin Laden as a hero. In the bazaar, you could buy posters of him on a white horse and boxes of sweets with his picture on them. These clerics said 9/11 was revenge on the Americans for what they had been doing to other people around the world. But they ignored the fact that the people in the World Trade Center were innocent and had nothing to do with American policy, and that the Holy Quran clearly says it is wrong to kill. Our people see conspiracies behind everything, and many argued that the attack was actually carried out by Jews as an excuse for America to launch a war on the Muslim world. Some of our newspapers printed stories that no Jews went to work at the World Trade Center that day. My father said this was rubbish. Musharraf told our people that he had no choice but to cooperate with the Americans. He said they had told him, either you are with us or you are with the terrorists, and threatened to bomb us back to the Stone Age if we stood against them. But we weren't exactly cooperating, as the ISI was still arming Taliban fighters and giving their leaders a sanctuary in Quetta. They even persuaded the Americans to let them fly hundreds of Pakistani fighters out of northern Afghanistan. The ISI chief asked the Americans to hold off their attack on Afghanistan until he had gone to Kandahar to ask the Taliban leader Mullah Omar to hand over bin Laden. Instead, he offered the Taliban help. In our province, Maulana Sufi Muhammad, a man who had fought in Afghanistan against the Russians, issued a fatwa against the US. He held a big meeting in Malakand, where our ancestors had fought the British. The Pakistani government didn't stop him. The governor of our province issued a statement that anyone who wanted to fight in Afghanistan against NATO forces was free to do so. Some 12,000 young men from Swat went to help the Taliban. Many never came back. They were most likely killed, but as there is no proof of death, their wives can't be declared widows. It's very hard on them. My father's close friend, Wahid Zaman's brother and brother-in-law, were among the many who went to Afghanistan. Their wives and children are still waiting for them. I remember visiting them and feeling their longing. Even so, it all seemed far, far away from our peaceful Garden Valley. Afghanistan is less than 100 miles away, but you have to go through the Bajau federally administered tribal area, Fatah, to get there. Bin Laden and his men fled to the White Mountains of Tora Bora in eastern Afghanistan, where he had built a network of tunnels while fighting the Russians. They escaped through these and over the mountains into the Kurram area of the Fatah. What we didn't know then was that Bin Laden came to Swat and stayed in a remote village for a year, taking advantage of Pashtunwali hospitality, which says we must protect guests. Anyone could see that Musharraf was double-dealing, taking American money while still helping the jihadis, strategic assets as the ISI calls them. The Americans say they gave Pakistan billions of dollars to help their campaign against Al-Qaeda, but we didn't see a single cent. Musharraf built a mansion by Rawal Lake in Islamabad and bought an apartment in London. Every so often, an important American official would complain that we weren't doing enough, and then suddenly some big fish would be caught. Khalik Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of 9/11, was found in a house just a mile from the army chief's official residence in Rawalpindi. But President Bush kept praising Musharraf, inviting him to Washington and calling him his buddy. My father and his friends were disgusted. They said the Americans always preferred dealing with dictators in Pakistan. From an early age, I was interested in politics and sat on my father's knee listening to everything he and his friends discussed. But I was more concerned with matters closer to home, our own street to be exact. I told my friends at school about the rubbish dump children and that we should help. Not everyone wanted to, as they said the children were dirty and probably diseased, and their parents would not like them going to school with children like that. They also said it wasn't up to us to sort out the problem. I didn't agree. We can sit by and hope the government will help, but they won't. If I can help support 1 or 2 children, and another family supports 1 or 2, then between us, we can help them all. I knew it was pointless appealing to Musharraf. In my experience, if my father couldn't help with matters like these, there was only one option. I wrote a letter to God. Dear God, I wrote, I know you see everything, But there are so many things that maybe, sometimes, things get missed. Particularly now with the bombing in Afghanistan. But I don't think you would be happy if you saw the children on my road living on a rubbish dump. God, give me strength and courage and make me perfect because I want to make this world perfect. Malala. The problem was, I did not know how to get it to him. Somehow I thought it needed to go deep into the earth. So first I buried it in the garden. Then I thought it would get spoilt. So I put it in a plastic bag. But that didn't seem much use. We like to put sacred texts in flowing waters. So I rolled it up, tied it to a piece of wood, placed a dandelion on top, and floated it in the stream which flows into the Swat River. Surely God would find it there. 7. The Mufti Who Tried to Close Our School. Just in front of the school on Khushal Street where I was born was the house of a tall, handsome mullah and his family. His name was Ghulamullahand. He called himself a Mufti, which means he is an Islamic scholar and authority on Islamic law, though my father complained that anyone with a turban can call themselves a Mullana or Mufti. The school was doing well, and my father was building an impressive reception with an arched entrance in the boys' high school. For the first time, my mother could buy nice clothes and even send out for food as she had dreamed of doing back in the village. But all this time, the Mufti was watching. He watched the girls going in and out of our school every day and became angry, particularly as some of the girls were teenagers. "That Mulana has a bad eye on us," said my father one day. He was right. Shortly afterwards, the Mufti went to the woman who owned the school premises and said, "Ziauddin is running a haram prohibited by Islam school in your building and bringing shame on the Mohalla neighborhood. These girls should be in Parda," he had told her. "Take this building back from him and I will rent it for my madrasa. If you do this, you will get paid now and also receive a reward in the next world." She refused, and her son came to my father in secret. "This Mulana is starting a campaign against you," he warned. "We won't give him the building, but be careful." My father was angry. Just as we say, "Nim Hakim Katrai Jan," half a doctor is a danger to one's life. So Nim Mulla Katrai Iman, a mullah who is not fully learned, is a danger to faith, he said. I am proud that our country was created as the world's first Muslim homeland. But we still don't agree on what this means. The Quran teaches us sabar, which means patience. But often it feels that we have forgotten the word and think Islam means women sitting at home in parda or wearing burqas while men do jihad. We have many strands of Islam in Pakistan. Our founder, Jinnah, wanted the rights of Muslim in India to be recognized, but the majority of people in India were Hindu. It was as if there was a feud between two brothers and they agreed to live in different houses. So British India was divided in August 1947 and an independent Muslim state was born. It could hardly have been a bloodier beginning. Millions of Muslims crossed from India and Hindus traveled in the other direction. Almost 2 million of them were killed trying to cross the new border. Many of them were slaughtered on trains which arrived at Lahore and Delhi full of bloodied corpses. My own grandfather narrowly escaped death in the riots when his train was attacked by Hindus on his way home from Delhi where he had been studying. Now we are a country of 180 million and more than 96% are Muslim. We also have around 2 million Christians and more than 2 million Ahmadis who say they are Muslims, though our government says they are not. Sadly, those minority communities are often attacked. Jinnah had lived in London as a young man and trained as a barrister. He wanted a land of tolerance. Our people often quote the famous speech he made a few days before independence. You are free to go to your temples, you are free to go to your mosques, or to any other place of worship in this state of Pakistan. You may belong to any religion or caste or creed that has nothing to do with the business of the state. My father says the problem is that Jinnah negotiated a piece of real estate for us, but not a state. He died of tuberculosis just a year after the creation of Pakistan, and we haven't stopped fighting since. We have had 3 wars against India, and what seems like endless killing inside our own country. We are split between Sunnis and Shias. We share the same fundamental beliefs and the same holy book of Quran, but we disagree over who was the right person to lead our religion when the Prophet died in the 7th century. The man chosen to be the leader of Ghalib was Abu Bakr, a close friend and advisor of the Prophet, and the man he chose to lead prayers as he lay on his deathbed. The word Sunni comes from the Arabic for one who follows the traditions of the Prophet. But a smaller group believed that leadership should have stayed within the Prophet's family, and that Ali, his son-in-law and cousin, should have taken over. They became known as Shias, shortened from Shiat Ali or Party of Ali. Every year, Shias commemorate the killing of the Prophet's grandson, Hussein ibn Ali, at the Battle of Karbala in the year 680 with a festival called Muharram. They whip themselves into a bloody frenzy with metal chains or razor blades on strings until the streets run red. One of my father's friends is a Shia, and he cries whenever he talks about Hussein's death at Karbala. His reaction couldn't be stronger if the events of Karbala had happened the night before. Our own founder Jinnah was a Shia, and Benazir Bhutto's mother was also a Shia from Iran. Most Pakistanis are Sunnis, more than 80%. But within that, we are again many groups. By far, the biggest group is the Barelvis, who are named after a 19th century madrasa in Bareilly, which lies in the Indian state of Uttar Pradesh. Then we have the Deobandi, named after another famous 19th century madrasa in Uttar Pradesh, this time in the village of Deoband. They are very conservative, and most of our madrasas are Deobandi. We also have the Ahle Hadith, people of the Hadith, who are Salafists. This group is more Arab-influenced and even more conservative than the others. They are what the West called fundamentalist. They don't accept our saints and shrines. Many Pakistanis are also mystical people and gather at Sufi shrines to dance and worship. Each of these strands has many different subgroups. The Mufti on Khushal Street was a member of Tablighi Jamaat, a Deobandi group that holds a huge rally every year at its headquarters in Raiwind near Lahore, attended by millions of people. Our last dictator, General Zia, used to go there, and in the 1980s under his regime, the Tablighis became very powerful. Many of the imams appointed to preach in army barracks were Tablighis, and army officers would often take leave and go on preaching tours for the group. One night, after the Mufti had failed to persuade our landlady to cancel our lease, he gathered some of the influential people and elders of our mohalla into a delegation and turned up at our door. There were 7 people, some other senior Tablighis, a mosque keeper, and a shopkeeper, and they filled our small house. My father seemed worried and shooed us into the other room, but the house was so small so we could hear every word. I am representing Ulema and Tabliya and Taliban, Mullah Ziaullah said, referring not to just one but 2 organizations of Muslim scholars to give himself gravitas. I am representing good Muslims, and we all think your girls' school is haram and a blasphemy. You should close it. Girls should not be going to school, he continued. A girl is so sacred she should be in parda, and so private that there is no lady's name in the Quran, as God doesn't want her to be named. My father could listen no more. Maryam is mentioned everywhere in the Quran, Was she not a woman, and a good woman at that? No, said the mullah. She's only there to prove that Isa, Jesus, was the son of Maryam, not the son of God. That may be, replied my father, but I am pointing out that the Quran names Maryam. The mufti started to object, but my father had had enough. Turning to the group, he said, When this gentleman passes me on the street, I look to him and greet him, but he doesn't answer. He just bows his head. The mullah looked down embarrassed, because greeting someone properly is important in Islam. You run the haram school, he said. That's why I don't want to greet you. Then one of the other men spoke up. I heard you were an infidel, he said to my father, but there are Qurans in your room. Of course there are, replied my father, astonished that his faith would be questioned. I am a Muslim. Let's get back to the subject of the school, said the mufti, who could see the discussion was not going his way. There are men in the reception area of the school, and they see the girls enter, and this is very bad. I have a solution, said my father. The school has another gate. The girls will enter through that. The mullah clearly wasn't happy, as he wanted the school closed altogether, but the elders were happy with this compromise, and they left. My father suspected this would not be the end of the matter. What we knew, and they didn't, was that the mullah's own niece attended the school in secret. So a few days later, my father called the mullah's elder brother, the girl's father. I'm very tired of your brother, he said. What kind of mullah is he? He's driving us crazy. Can you help to get him off our backs? I'm afraid I can't help you, Ziauddin, he replied. I have trouble in my home too. He lives with us and has told his wife that she must observe parda from us, and that our wives must observe parda from him, all in this small space. Our wives are like sisters to him, and his like a sister to us, but this madman has made our house a hell, so I am sorry, but I can't help you. My father was right to think this man was not going to give up. Mullahs had become more powerful figures since Zia's rule and campaign of Islamization. In some ways, General Musharraf was very different from our last dictator, General Zia. Though he usually dressed in uniform, he occasionally wore Western suits, and he called himself Chief Executive instead of Chief Martial Law Administrator. He also kept dogs, which we Muslims regard as unclean. Instead of Zia's Islamization, he began what he called enlightened moderation. He opened up our media, allowing new private TV channels and female newsreaders, as well as showing dancing on television. The celebration of Western holidays was allowed, such as Valentine's Day and New Year's Eve. He even sanctioned an annual pop concert on the eve of Independence Day, which was broadcast to the nation. He did something which our democratic rulers hadn't, even Benazir, and abolished the law that for a woman to prove she was raped, she had to produce 4 male witnesses. He appointed the first woman governor of the state bank and the first women airline pilots and coast guards. He even announced we would have female guards at Jinnah's tomb in Karachi. However, in our Pashtun homeland of Northwest Frontier Province, things were very different. In 2002, Musharraf held elections for controlled democracy. There were strange elections as the main party leaders, Nawaz Sharif and Benazir, were in exile. In our province, these elections brought what we called a mullah government to power. The Mutahida Majlis-e-Amal, MMA Alliance, was a group of 5 religious parties, including the Jamiat Ulema Islam, JUI, which ran the madrasas where the Taliban were trained. People jokingly referred to the MMA as the Mullah Military Alliance and said they got elected because they had Musharraf's support. But some people supported them because the very religious Pashtuns were angry at the American invasion of Afghanistan and the removal of the Taliban from power there. Our area had always been more conservative than most of the rest of Pakistan. During the Afghan Jihad, many madrasas had been built, most of them funded by Saudi money, and many young men had passed through them as it was free education. That was the start of what my father calls the Arabization of Pakistan. Then 9/11 had made this militancy more mainstream. Sometimes when I walked along the main road, I saw chalked messages on the sides of buildings. "Contact us for jihad training," they would say, listing a phone number to call. In those days, jihadi groups were free to do whatever they wanted. You could see them openly collecting contributions and recruiting men. There was even a headmaster from Shangla who would boast that his greatest success was to send 10 boys in grade 9 for jihad training in Kashmir. The MMA government banned CD and DVD shops and wanted to create a morality police like the Afghan Taliban had set up. The idea was that they would be able to stop a woman accompanied by a man and ask to prove that that man was her relative. Thankfully, our Supreme Court stopped this. Then MMA activists launched attacks on cinemas and tore down billboards with pictures of women or blacked them out with paint. They even snatched female mannequins from clothing shops. They harassed men wearing Western-style shirts and trousers instead of the traditional shalwar kameez and insisted women cover their heads. It was as though they wanted to remove all traces of womankind from public life. My father's high school opened in 2003. That first year, they had boys and girls together. But by 2004, the climate had changed, so it was unthinkable to have girls and boys in the same class. That changing climate made Zia-ullah bold. One of the school clerks told my father that the Mufti kept coming into school and demanding why we girls were still using the main entrance. He said that one day, when a male member of staff took a female teacher out to the main road to get a rickshaw, the Molana asked, "Why did this man escort her to the road? Is he her brother?" "No," replied the clerk, "he's a colleague." "That is wrong," said the Molana. My father told the clerk to call him next time he saw the Molana. When the call came, my father and the Islamic studies teacher went out to confront him. "Molana, you have driven me to the wall," my father said. "Who are you? You are crazy. You need to go to a doctor. You think I enter the school and take my clothes off? When you see a boy and a girl, you see a scandal. They are school children. I think you should go and see Dr. Haider Ali." Dr. Haider Ali was a known psychiatrist in our area. So to say, "Shall we take you to Dr. Haider Ali," meant, "Are you mad?" The Mufti went quiet. He took off his turban and put it in my father's lap. For us, a turban is a public symbol of chivalry and Pashtunness. And for a man to lose his turban is considered a great humiliation. But then he started up again. "I never said those things to your clerk. He is lying." My father had had enough. "You have no business here," he shouted. "Go away." The Mufti had failed to close our school, but his interference was an indication of how our country was changing. My father was worried. He and his fellow activists were holding endless meetings. These were no longer about stopping people cutting down trees, but also about education and democracy. In 2004, after resisting pressure from Washington for more than 2.5 years, General Musharraf sent the army into the federally administered tribal areas, 7 agencies that lie along the border with Afghanistan, where the government had little control. The Americans claimed that the Al-Qaeda militants who had fled from Afghanistan during the U.S. bombing were using the areas as a safe haven, taking advantage of our Pashtun hospitality. From there, they were running training camps and launching raids across the border on NATO troops. For us in Swat, this was very close to home. One of the agencies, Bajor, is next to Swat. The people who live in the Fatah are all from Pashtun tribes like us, Yusufzai, and live on both sides of the border with Afghanistan. The tribal agencies were created in British times as a buffer zone between Afghanistan and what was then India, and they are still run in the same way, administered by tribal chiefs or elders known as Maliks. Unfortunately, the Maliks make little difference. In truth, the tribal areas are not governed at all. They are forgotten places of harsh rocky valleys where people scrape by on smuggling. Their average annual income is just $250, half the Pakistani average. They have very few hospitals and schools, particularly for girls, and political parties were not allowed there until recently. Hardly any women from these areas can read. Their people are renowned for their fierceness and independence, as you can see if you read any of the old British accounts. Our army had never before gone into the Fatah. Instead, they had maintained indirect control in the same way the British had, relying on the Pashtun-recruited frontier corps rather than regular soldiers. Sending in the regular army was a tough decision. Not only did our army and the ISI have long links with some of those militants, but it also meant our troops would be fighting their own Pashtun brothers. The first tribal area that the army entered was South Waziristan in March 2004. Predictably, the local people saw it as an attack on their way of life. All the men there carry weapons, and hundreds of soldiers were killed when the locals revolted. The army was in shock. Some men refused to fight, not wishing to battle their own people. They retreated after just 12 days and reached what they called a negotiated peace settlement with local militant leaders like Naik Muhammad. This involved the army trying to bribe them into promising to halt all attacks and keep out foreign fighters. The militants simply used the cash to buy more weapons and resumed their activities. A few months later came the first attack on Pakistan by a US drone. On 17th June 2004, an unmanned Predator dropped a Hellfire missile on Naik Muhammad in South Waziristan, apparently while he was giving an interview by satellite phone. He and the men around him were killed instantly. Local people had no idea what it was. Back then, we did not know that the Americans could do such a thing. Whatever you thought about Naik Muhammad, we were not at war with the Americans, and were shocked that they would launch attacks from the sky on our soil. Across the tribal areas, people were angry, and many joined militant groups or formed lashkars or local militias. Then there were more attacks. The Americans said that Bin Laden's deputy, Ayman al-Zawahiri, was hiding in Bajur and had taken a wife there. In January 2006, a drone supposedly targeting him landed on a village called Damadola, destroying 3 houses and killing 18 people. The Americans said he had been tipped off and escaped. That same year, on 30th October, another US Predator hit a madrasa on a hill near the main town of Khar, killing 82 people, many of them young boys. The Americans said it was the Al-Qaeda training camp which had featured in the group's videos, and that the hill was riddled with tunnels and gun emplacements. Within a few hours of the attack, an influential local cleric called Fakir Muhammad, who had run the madrasa, announced that the deaths would be avenged by suicide bombings against Pakistani soldiers. My father and his friends were worried and called together local elders and leaders for a peace conference. It was a bitterly cold night in January, but 150 people gathered. "It's coming here," my father warned. "The fire is reaching the valley. Let's put out the flames of militancy before they reach here." But no one would listen. Some people even laughed, including a local political leader sitting in the front row. "Mr. Khan," my father said to him, "you know what happened to the people of Afghanistan. They are now refugees and they're living with us. The same is happening with Bajur. The same will happen to us. Mark my words. And we will have no shelter, no place to migrate to." But the expression on the man's face was mocking. Look at this man, he seemed to be saying of my father. I am a Khan. Who would dare kick me out of this area? My father came home frustrated. I have a school, but I am neither a Khan nor a political leader. I have no platform, he said. I am only one small man. 8. The Autumn of the Earthquake. One fine October day, when I was still in primary school, our desks started to tremble and shake. Our classes were still mixed at that age, and all the boys and girls yelled, "Earthquake!" We ran outside as we had been taught to do. All the children gathered around our teachers as chicks swarmed to a mother hen. SWAT lies on a fault line, and we often had earthquakes, but this felt different. All the buildings around us seemed to be shaking, and the rumbling didn't stop. Most of us were crying, and our teachers were praying. Miss Ruby, one of my favorite teachers, told us to stop crying and to stay calm. It would soon be over. Once the shaking had